This is Joe Leith, 1981 Midland, Texas Winter Conference.
Mike and I came early and stood over here, and there's a big fellow weighed 300 pounds. Was strapping this microphone here, and when he got it on, he hit it a couple of big licks like that to be sure it was rigidly secured. And then he drew back and with his 300 pounds blew all the filament out of it. And Mike said, "That microphone will not work." And I said, "Yes or no?" "What do you think we ought to do?" I said, "Let's sit down and watch it." And immediately the chairman, so-called, got into a running battle with some hecklers in the back. And it continued to grow worse. And then a bookkeeper over here with a pocket knife came back here and stabbed it. And all the while there's another little fella running and looking out the door and coming over here and looking out the door. I fully expected him to come back and tell us that they had fired on Fort Sumter. Then there was a truck driver who came running over with a screwdriver and stabbed the bookkeeper. This is what we call participation. Now, and then the wisdom of the old timer came to the top. And one of the oldest members decided that this thing would work if he'd come up here and shout in it. And he came up and shouted something about the grapevine and Exxon and something else, I don't know. And he finally ran out of wind and went back and sat down. In the meantime, the little feller's still running back and forth. Finally, a barber stuck his head in with a wet towel and saw that he wasn't needed and left. And some feller came from way in the back. He was an old member, too. And he got about this far and shook his head and turned around and went back. Now, the way this thing stopped was from sheer exhaustion. And I have come to the conclusion that no problem is too small to baffle the alcoholic. I don't know. I've been overwhelmed by this convention. I really have. We had Clancy Friday night. And we had Clancy Friday night. We had lots of Clancy Friday night. Those people from California are strange. I've always wondered about them. We went over to them. How would one from California know if he had been sent to the insane asylum? Yeah. We went over to the rubber room for the terminally bewildered over in Big Springs where Clancy used to hold forth. And it was my day to take the pill, so I was looking for the restroom. And I went into the restroom, and one of the inmates was in there, had his ear up against the wall. And I stood and looked at him for a minute, and he said, and I put my ear up against the wall. And then I said, I don't hear anything. And he said, it's been like that all day. Okay. Clancy made a real spiritual talk on how to cheat at polo. And he talked to 42 patients and 51 counselors. And he made a hit with all of them. Out in the West Coast, they say that Clancy works real well with crazy people. I wonder why. But this thing has been marvelous to me to come here to Midland. I was here January the 24th, 1971. I drove home in a terrible snowstorm. And before daylight the next morning, I was called and they told me that our beloved Bill had passed away. And I've associated that with this great group. And I think that when Eve was talking this morning about the cherished memories that we keep in the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, some of them are not so pleasant, but still good. And this place is empty tonight for a little fellow named Bob that was up at Lamesa, who was one of the forerunners of our society. And it's a tender place. And I suspect that those of us who have been here for a little while have stacked up many memories that are all good. They're all good. And the fear sets upon us sometimes. The maybe that the people who come along later will not do it as well as we. And this is a great misapprehension, I suppose, because I'm not the least bit worried about our society when I can come and see a place like this. AA is alive and well in Midland, Texas today. And we old people shouldn't sit about and just look. In the animal world, if those of you who know about the mink and the rest of those mammals, when you panic them, they will eat their young. And in AA, when you panic them, they eat the old. When I was a new man in Alcoholics Anonymous, full of that stuff, whatever it may be, one night I was washing the cups and a fellow came up to me and said, "You got the right attitude." You're going to go a long way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm watching you. And I literally beamed at him. 25 years later, I picked up the same cups and started washing them, and a young man was heard to say, "Look at the old bastard, he's still trying to run this outfit." These people out here in Midland, I've never been to a place like this, that so many rich folks out here. Everybody out here is so damn rich that they can buy out everybody else. We had dinner yesterday with a fella that's got enough money to burn a wet mule with. And he has literally spoiled us, feeding us both days out at the country club out there. My wife's going to catch hell when I get home. I don't know how to talk tonight. I've heard so much. I was so filled with what I've already heard. But I've got special dispensation from the committee, and they're going to let me talk tonight a little about my drinking. You know, AA's gotten so fashionable now that you don't hear about it too much. We used to worry about the stigma on alcoholism, you know. Didn't want anybody to know. Now our biggest problem is keeping out the social climbers in AA. But there's still a stigma on alcoholism, no matter what you may think. And if you're coming to AA to make any points, forget it. I got a nephew in Dallas that's a psychiatrist. And I got another nephew in San Francisco that's a homosexual. And you know my people brag on them more than they do on me. I don't know, how do we get started here? This pastor, I'm scared of them damn Methodists. They look at you like you got a fried chicken head in your pocket all the time. You know that, right? They ought to get us a good Presbyterian up here every now and then. They don't bother nobody. Years ago, I know that Eve and I are both opera buffs. Years ago, there were what they called itinerant opera groups. They used to come down in the South and bring culture to we people. And they were a rather seedy lot, these itinerant opera groups, and they were working on a low budget, and they couldn't carry a full complement of people. All they carried was the singing roles. And the roles that did not have any dialogue, they hired them on the spot. So they were playing in one of our East Texas towns and doing either Il Trovatore or Rigoletto or something. And in the last act, the tenor had the big role, you know, them tenors always throwing their weight around anyway. And he was supposed to stab his lover in the very last scene. And the lover happened to be an old girl that he had hired right there. And that blocks her out and showed her what she'd supposed to do. And in this scene, he was singing, and it came to the proper moment, and he took the rubber knife and stabbed the girl, and give her a couple of good ones for good measure. And she kind of got carried away with herself there, and she reeled around and really put her heart in it. And finally, she fell over and kicked a couple of times and lay dead. And then this was the time for the tenor to go into his last song. And the words went like this. Ah, my love. Oh, my love. What have I done? What have I done, my love? And there was a drunk got up in the back with tears in his eyes. And he said, I'll tell you what you've done. You've killed the only whore in Waxahachie. I didn't know he was a lawyer. He's been going around with his hands in his own pockets. Oh, man. I don't know. I didn't set out to be an alcoholic per se. You know where sad per se is, don't you, Clay? I just didn't set out to be a drunk. I did not do that. I came from a... Oh, God, here we go again. Came from a fine Christian family. I've heard that so much that I've come to believe that fine Christian families are breeding places for alcoholism. And I... came up like any ordinary boy. I don't know, I think I'll let you in on a little secret. I learned about this classical music at an early age. I'll have to date myself. We had the old Victrola with the big horn on it. Oh yeah, don't you remember that? We would listen to Emile Caruso and Adelina Patti and Jenny Lynn. Those are great voices. And this music teacher, bless her heart, she had a big breast. Had a breast like a pheasant, by God. And I was 13 and a half years old. And was cracking all over the place. It was just about to happen. And the people had told me that I was a precocious child. I didn't know what precocious meant. I knew it was something different. And this teacher took a special interest in me. Maybe because I was precocious. And she kept me after school and tried to teach me to sing. And she was about to give up. She put her hands over on my chest one day and she said, sing now. And of course I cracked and cracked and cracked, and she said, lower, lower, lower from your diaphragm. Please sing lower. And then she said, put your hands over on my chest. And she said, what do you think now? And I said, abba, abba, abba. And we cranked that old Victrola up real tight and went into the cloakroom. And while listening to Brunhilde's battle cry from the Ride of the Valkyries, I became a baritone. And she had, but she sure had a cure for precocious, I'll tell you. But I took my first drink at age 17. Purely to be accepted in a group of guys. Purely to be accepted that night. And I remember it as vividly as though it were yesterday. And I remember it, and I love to remember it and let Clancy talk about it because he's so adept at describing the first drink. You know, I think that if we looked deep enough, we would find that the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic is that that drink means something to us. I think that the alcoholic in most cases can remember that first encounter with alcohol. That is an exhilaration that is beyond any description devised by God or man, as far as I'm concerned. I would not attempt to delineate upon it what happened when I took that first drink. Oh, you know what happened when I took that first drink. I don't know, people don't understand us. I was at a seminar the other day, and a doctor popped me with a quick question, and he said, "What's the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic?" Kind of took me by surprise, you know. And I thought for a minute, and I said, "You know, I believe that alcoholics drink more than non-alcoholics." And then he said, "Why is it that non-alcoholics don't become alcoholics?" And I said, "Hell, that's the easiest question of all. They ain't got no willpower." "You got to be gutsy to get where we are, I'll tell you. Takes a lot of willpower." But I remember that first drink. And for the next 18 and a half years, I shot at it. And never made it. That original drink, if I could recapture this great exhilaration of that first drink, and I have never compared one with it to this day. It was that vivid in my memory. I don't know. AA is not so many things that it is not for us. I see. AA is not a religion. You newcomers. Some lines in our books that say that we don't need to be philosophically comforted. That we don't need a new code of morals. If that was all we needed, we'd have been drunk or sober a long time ago. But I sometimes wish that we were a religion. Then I could shout and promise my way into sobriety. And I wouldn't have to work them damn steps. But it's not a religion. I don't know. I was up in Chicago when the Pope came. And I stood way deep in the audience back there. He was in a fine fettle that morning, and I was not close enough to see everything that went on. I only got it by hearsay. But they said that he performed a couple of warm-up miracles there. Did one of the things that I have thought was absolutely impossible. He healed up an Al-Anon's mouth. And then he started talking in all these various and sundry languages. He went from Latin to Greek to Norwegian to Polish. Then he started talking in institutional and finally ended up talking in shorthand. And there was a drunk standing next to me and he said, "What did he say?" And I said, "He said, read the book, go to the meetings. Don't take a drink." But alcohol was an answer instead of a problem for a long time. And I ended up, the reason that I can so lavishly get all over these people from California, that's where I went. I honestly believe that that state line out there must be radioactive. When you get into California, your eyes glaze over and you begin to babble, it seems to me. They're a strange lot. They're always anxious to visit Texas for some reason or other. So I ended up in California, and of all places, I was in Hollywood with accents in the middle. A country boy from East Texas. Can you imagine that? And a kind Jewish fellow took me in to his firm out there and was going to teach me one of the finest professions that you can imagine, the designing of ladies' lingerie. And this is a kick for a drunk, I'll tell you. It's a fun profession. This is where you cut those soft, silk, sleazy, intimate things that the ladies wear. Now, we've got a step in Alcoholics Anonymous called the second step. That's the one that infers that you might have a gopher in the garden. If you cut a bunch of brassieres with three of them places in it, you're nuts. And I told a psychiatrist about that, and he said it was just wishful thinking. But this is the beginning of the travel through what we call the processes of alcoholism. This is the beginning of the hurts and the humiliations that follow the alcoholic until he falls off of that stool. This Jewish fellow came to me one day and said these words, and I suppose there's never been any as horrible said to one of us. He said, "You can't drink." And you know what a drunk does when you tell him you can't do something. Don't you know that? We can't stand can't. We just cannot stand don't do that. I was very recently up in the University of Illinois making a talk in an immense dining room like this. And I'd talk a while and look over at the sign on the wall, and it said, "Don't take the dishes out of this hall." And I'd talk a little while in my head. And I have got two of them damn dishes at home. And they have absolutely no collectible value. Don't do this. You can't do that. And he said to me, "You can't drink." And I suppose this is the horrible thing that comes face to face with us. You can't drink. And of course we set out to show them that we can, and we end up by showing them again that we can't. He was a rather whimsical fellow, this Jewish guy. He came to me one day and right off like that, "You're fired." And then he smiled and grinned and he said, "You know, there's a little good comes out of everything." He said, "The way you handle those scissors, if you would have been a rabbi, you would have destroyed our whole race." This is the job number one. I would love to say to you that I've recently retired out of my fifth profession. All of these subsequent things that I did were dedicated to the use of alcohol. I moved and moved and moved. And this has been the treatment for alcoholism down through the centuries until the advent of Alcoholics Anonymous. The treatment for alcoholism was keep him moving. No family likes to admit they've got one of us. It's not bridge table gossip yet. What's that sound I hear in the back room? Oh, that's my son. He's an alcoholic, you know. Keep him moving. And I went out into the shipyard and Terminal Island. The war was going on at that time, and I literally bought a plumber's license out the back door of a union hall. Went into the shipyard as a master plumber. Here's a fellow that's never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors. You know I was a master fraud. And here we go again. Those were the days when you were frozen to your job. What are they saying to me? You can't quit. Who can't quit? I have a pink document, very impressive looking document that hangs in my den today. And it is signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. Who can't quit? So then we hear the plaintiff cry, no, none of you Al-Anons have ever heard this. Honey, let's go somewhere else where we don't know anybody. What we're saying is where nobody knows us. And then we begin to move. And a practicing alcoholic always ends up to be a moving, self-contained unit. Until the day he falls off of the stool. We moved up into Northern California there's come some of that chicken. Now I hear people get up behind the podium in Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes I suspect that some of us get rather competitive about the bad things that have happened to us. You've heard them. Matching stories in AA. I can win this contest with no further ado. When we moved from Los Angeles to Sacramento, I was run over by the welcome wagon. I remember how embarrassed that lady was. and trying to give me some tickets to the car wash, and I'm laying under her front fender. And I hadn't had a car in 15 years. Here we go. Went to work, of all places, for the railroad. Seems to me that in the progression of alcoholism, and I believe Clancy will bear me out in this, that as we go along, the arrow seems to point down. You ever see those liquor stores down in East Texas where the arrow points down? Ain't a goddamn thing up there. It's all down here. This is the way of the alcoholic and his progression and the selection of things for him to do becomes less and less. So I went to work for the railroad. And I'd love to say here that those people, I believe, are the most narrow-minded people that I've ever seen. There you go. I have breakfast every morning with a corporate lawyer who represents four railroads. And he says that railroad people are the highest paid bunch of ignorant sons of bitches he's ever seen in his life. Don't holler no more. The railroads live with the theory they've got a rule about drinking, in case you didn't know. And it reads, in essence, that if you're seen coming out of a place that dispenses alcoholic beverages, you can be fired. I never came out very often. And if I did then, I was propelled through the air at such a speed that I was not identifiable. Now, they have this rule, I suspect, for good cause. They run more than one train on a track. How they do this has always boggled my mind. And I lived in a state of horror, knowing that one day it had happened to me. Now, this railroad went over the terrible terrain of the Sierra Nevada mountains in Northern California, and they used a lot of helper engines to push a train up from Roseville to over to Norden. And at the top of this mountain, if you follow this vernacular, this parlance, they had what they call an interlocking system. This is a highly defined thing put out by the Sperry Company. And the railroad had the unmitigated effrontery to hang a sign up in the depot. You know, they use bulletins on the railroad. They're about like the government, Hal. They're about 20% efficient. And this bulletin read, in essence, about this interlocking system at the top of the mountain, it is physically impossible, they say, to make a mistake. That's just like, don't take the dishes out of this house. I used to walk through the depot just to get to read that sign. Physically impossible. What are they saying to me, or to any other alcoholic like me? Well, I don't know of anybody that wouldn't have had a whack at that one. One night, I I got two engines going towards one another with four cars between them, carrots, apples, lettuce, and celery. And I made the biggest goddamn Waldorf salad that in recorded history. And do you know they wanted to fire me? They had an investigation, and I got another alcoholic to represent me. And he proved a thing that better than you. He proved a thing that was about a million to one shot. That a Mexican been walking along swinging the lantern at night looking at the track, and I took his lantern as a given signal. And I got off with 60 days. And when the old superintendent came out of that investigation, he was absolutely livid with rage. He knew that he had been had by a drunk. He was apoplectic with rage. He was a big man. And he came out of that investigation and he said, "You ought to be arrested for even walking on our right-of-way." And then he said something that a lot of our Al-Anons have said. "I'll get you if it's the last thing I ever do." And the irony of our illness, you don't have to get even with an alcoholic. You don't have to get even with an alcoholic. There's nothing that you can call him. There's nothing you can say to him that he hasn't already said to himself while crying in a pillow at night. He's got a little mechanism in him, if you leave him to his own devices, he'll get even with himself. We've got the biggest PR working for us out there than any other facet of society. We got alcohol out there working for us. And there's some lines in the Book of Experience that read, "Alcohol was the great persuader. It beat us into a state of reasonableness." That's in our Book of Experience. When I see people coming here, they come, I hope, because alcohol sends them. And if they leave, I suspect it will be alcohol that takes them away. This is the penalty. I sat amazed this morning and listened to Dear Eve stand up here, and I wondered what would fascinate a human being so much with a society that after 35 years, then we're still hacking it here. The penalty is swift and sure. He will sicken and die. This is what we got working for us. We got the penalty of failure in AA. When the price of failure gets so high, you don't want to pay it anymore. You might be in a state of receptiveness to the suggestions of the conditions of our sobriety. Do you believe that? And this is what we're here for. I think that when we begin to deteriorate in the end, it's a big landslide. Whoosh, like that. Over the top and down. Seems to me that everything I touched suddenly decayed. I was not right with anybody. And I suspect that maybe physically, as pitiful as I presently am, I might be able to stand another drunk. Physically. But I do not want 5 minutes more of the humiliation and the indignities that are heaped upon that defenseless alcoholic. I don't think I could hack it up here. 5 minutes of the defenselessness of an alcoholic. And here again, AA's takes care of it. I thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that these things that I had done that lived with me so far day and night that I was going to have to get rid of them. And this was one of the greatest misapprehensions that I ran into in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to read you a line that comes from our chapter about putting the family back together again. And it goes like this, and I like for the gals to hear it. They carry the greatest burden of shame with us. It reads like this. Cling to the thought that in God's hands your dark past is the greatest treasure you possess. How do you like the contingency of God's hands? Cling to the thought that in God's hands your dark past is the greatest treasure you possess. Then we get a promise in the following sentence that no other facet of society would even dare to believe. With it, your dark past, you can avert death and misery for others. What other facet of society is so fortunate as we for a gift like this? To take the absolute useless and the absolute helpless, the fumbling people that we were, bestow upon us a gift like this. This is the reason that you see folks come into AA after they're a few years sober. And I wondered when I saw Eve sitting here, 35 years, 35 years and still hacking it. And I thought I'd wander around. I'd take a little poll. I don't ever like to be left in the dark about it. And I talked to Clancy. And I talked to Eve. And I talked to Bob. And I talked to Joe. Let me tell you how come they're still up here. You won't ever have to doubt about it again. In the last 2 weeks, every one of these old-timers has talked to a wet drunk. Every one of them. I took a poll on it. Every one of them, beginning in the last 2 weeks, has been to 5 through 12 AA meetings. Every one of them. So don't ever ask why they stand here 35 years sober. This is what AA is like. I went to hell in a hurry and I went down and down. There's no use in telling it. Suffering is the same, I suppose. And I don't know, I left to use some fine sounding language. I used to say I left California a thoroughly discredited man. The fact is they ran my butt out of the state. I went to a psychiatrist one time. The first question that he asked me said, "Do you ever feel unwanted?" When I came to AA, I was wanted in 2 states and not wanted in 46 others. Now here's the hot cat, the resourceful guy, the smart man with all of the answers. Me, sharp, the fellow from Beverly Hills and Hollywood, walking back to Texas. Went back home. Hated it with a purple passion. Hated everything that Tyler stood for. And I went back to Mama. I had a delightful childhood. It lasted 44 years. And this is the reversal of the story of the prodigal son. They saw him coming from afar. And threw his butt in jail. People make a big hack about identification in A. I keep hearing it. For God's sake, I can identify with any person who has ever drank an ounce of alcohol against their own will. I can identify with you. Years ago, we used to have a pamphlet, still have it, I believe it was 44 questions, came out of John the Hopps University, and all them eggheads up there wrote it. And they were little, simple, innocuous questions that, some of them were stringent, but a few of them, little, simple questions like, did your wife give you that look today? Or did you gargle with too much Lavoris? And somehow they didn't seem to fit my particular situation in alcoholism. Now I have contrived some questions here out of my own sheer genius that I think it will take less than 44 for you to identify with me. Have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Have you ever been arrested while in jail? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving? Have you ever woke up with a circus midget in bed with you? You heard about that midget that got thrown out of the nudist colony because he was going around getting his nose in everybody's business? Have you ever done the Tennessee Waltz in a straitjacket? I think here's the one that will affiliate most of you. Have you ever woke up in the morning feeling rather delicately and lose your eyeglasses and wash your teeth with Preparation H? That'll give you a pucker. Good morning, dear. I don't think we have to go much further here from the reception than we get. I believe that some of you cats may be ready for us, if you respond to that. But even the response of that is the delightful thing, the cure-all for our disease. And that's in a bit of laughter. For God's sake, I got tired of crying. I have cried all I want to into that pillow at night. There's a line in our book that says, why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered. We have recovered. And you have the license for the freedom of laughter with abandon. And there is no music as beautiful to my ears as the unlimited laughter of the recovered alcoholic. This is from heaven, if you please. I'm in jail, and it's hurt my feelings. I don't know, it hurt worse than any other experience I ever had. Wasn't my first jail, wasn't my last. But somehow or other it was particularly cutting to me to come home, this man of great resource, to come home and be humiliated again. Isn't that a hell of a word, that humiliated again? And of all things, for my own mother, here I am, cooped up in a little 5x5 and hating my own mother for bringing this great humiliation down upon me. And now maybe we won't laugh so much. One Monday morning there came a fellow into my cell whom I had never seen before. And he asked for me by name. And I'm going to use a word now that if you don't remember anything else I say tonight, remember this word. He came unsolicited. If you dingbats had waited for me to call you, I'd have had to die. I would have had to die. And there seems to be a great misapprehension around our society. Alcoholics, you know, if a drunk says something for 3 days and nobody argues with him, it becomes a law. And this is where we get all of the screwball cliches. You don't hear many old members in Alcoholics Anonymous using cliches. Just the new ones. And I suspect that cliches have been contrived, mostly, to make disaster more palatable. Don't you think? But we hear in AA, AA works by attraction rather than promotion. You better forget it. Our public relations policy works by attraction rather than promotion. That's the way we get along with them dingbats outside out there. That's when we show them our left hip pocket. Our staying alive policy is not that. Now I shall read to you the first paragraph of chapter 7 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That's that big blue one. About that wide, about that high. We're hoping that it'll catch on one day. Practical experience shows us that the surest immunity against drinking is extensive work with other alcoholics. This works when all other activities fail. When your prayer group blows it, when your transcendental meditation group blows it? When your sitting and touching group blows it? This works when all other activities fail. Then the command. I suspect there are not more than 3 exclamation marks in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is followed by an exclamation mark. And it says unequivocally, carry this message to the other alcoholics. The guy that stood in front of me in that cell had read it, and he had read it well. He didn't come to that cell to do anything for me. We don't go to see alcoholics because they're alcoholics. We go to see alcoholics because we're alcoholics. He had a job to do to perpetuate his own sobriety. He knew he had to do it, and he went to see a most arrogant, unreceptive, sarcastic bastard like me to do his job. I'm so thankful that in his search for someone to perpetuate his own sobriety that I was the victim. God knows I'm glad for that. That's the reason I stand here presently. It's because he'd read that and read it well. Oh, I was so filled with hatred and bitterness that I didn't follow him out. No, I was too smart. No. I took a few bites at him and asked him, "Who sent you to see me? This is who I particularly wanted to hate." I went to see a drunk not so long ago, and he had the bed sheet rolled up like a pencil. And he looked up to me out of those bloodshot eyes and said, "Who turned me into that outfit, you know?" And I know just how he felt, you know. I know just how he felt. I didn't want it. Didn't want it. But something happened here. If you read a book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you find that strange word occurring in chapter after chapter. What happened? What happened? Something happened in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. When he went back and reported to my people and told them, "Hoo, hoo, hoo, he's not ready." Boy, that's killed a lot of us. What color does a drunk turn when he's ready? My people are very substantial citizens down there, at least they were, and they hired 2 deputy sheriffs to load me into a police car. Wouldn't even let me come home after the bags. They sent the bags down to the jail. And they carried me 200 miles and put me on a train going west. This is the treatment down through the centuries for the alcoholic. Keep him moving. Keep him moving. Until this great miracle happened that was set up for you and I. When somebody let us stop long enough to find out why we take. I hope for you, one hope tonight, that Alcoholics Anonymous can mean as much in your recovery as it does to me. To me, it's not honor to bond, it's privilege. And I'm so glad it's like it is. I'm so glad those guys were there. So glad that somebody who was 35 years old in AA kept going. Kept it going. That's the reason I'm here. Well, I went back to the West Coast. And you remember the old Southern Pacific Station in Los Angeles. I'd gotten off of the train in San Antonio and filled up a bag with the only thing that I know to fill a bag up with. And I kind of set up shop in one of the toilets. And when we were in Los Angeles, some smart aleck said, "You've got to get out. You can't live here. We're going to use this car some more." And they took me in, three dirty old bags, and took me out in the front foyer of the old Southern Pacific Depot, and very unceremoniously heaved me over. And I can honestly say to you, for the next 5 months, it's beyond description. I drank like few people have and lived to tell the tale. Ended up under the bridge in Sacramento. And years ago, when you said under the bridge in Sacramento, most of the time it was the final remark. Very few got out. I've seen them walk off into the water and leave bubbles. Leave bubbles. I finally upped my living standards and moved to a flop house. Up yours too. And I'm in there. Somewhere, time doesn't mean anything to the sick alcoholic, I guess I punched my ticket into this great and fabulous society. One night, I wasn't sober, believe you me, but one night I had all of me I could stand. I'd gotten rid of you a long time ago, but this night was my night. And I fell and cried, "God help me." That's our ticket to AA. That's the willingness that is referred to in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. All that is needed for beginning is the willingness. God help me. And I walked back to Texas to find this fellow that had come to see me in that jail. Can you imagine telling a dramatic and sad story like that about walking 2,600 miles from Sacramento to Tyler, Texas? And when I'd been sober 3 months, I discovered and that there was an AA club 3 blocks from that damn flop house. It'll shoot the hell out of a tearjerker for you, I'll tell you that. And this time it's different. This time it's different, and I look for the guy. And he took me to my first AA meeting. Oh, God, I've had to compare every other AA meeting with that one that night. And I think that if there's any responsibility that we assume with this gift, that it's what we show that drunk that first night. When he leaves there that night, whatever you have done, good or bad, to him, that is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's our responsibility. And those people that night did their job and they did it well, or it seemed to me. And I suspect that all Alcoholics Anonymous is what it seems to me. And it seems to me that they quit everything they were doing and hovered around me. Some dingbat came up to me that looked like he had about a third grade education. He had on a pair of overalls. And he looked at me and he said, "We glad you are here." And I looked around and I thought, who's glad I'm here? God Almighty. What is the gift of acceptance in this society? What is this great gift that we receive at that first meeting that night? This gift of love and hope and understanding, if you please, that can make an absolute nothing come to life. It is bound to be the gift of Almighty God. Oh, I got well in a hurry. You know, have you ever seen a new guy get well in a big hurry? 2 weeks and I knew it all. I quit cussing. I became holy. You might even say that I became godlike. Have you ever seen any AA members who are godlike? And I got a call from a drunk one night, and I went in a nice new automobile I had, took another drunk with me, and we went to retrieve this drunk. And all he wanted, really, was for us to retrieve his bottle. He didn't want what we had. But I was so godlike, I couldn't see that. And I set him between me and another AA member, and I began to give him the pitch. Oh, God, was I eloquent. And as we drove slowly, the tears came into his eyes, and I thought, I'm getting him. And as we further drove on with more eloquence and piousity, if you please, he lay his head over on my shoulder. And I knew I had him. Did you ever hear of a drunk puking silently? Every time I've ever gotten godlike with them, they puke on me. I can't do it. If you're going to read one of them pamphlets to him over the foot of the bed, you better be a quick reader. Or he'll get you. I don't know how long you hack it with somebody in AA. I worked with a guy when I was new. I worked with a guy for 4.5 years. Went out to get him one Sunday morning, and my wife had accepted the call, and she said, yes, Joe will come. And when I got out there, he was looked a whole lot like me. And he was scurvy as hell. And I borrowed a goblet full of whiskey, and I poured down him. He was verging on DTs. And I knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshuckled from that drink, he was in an AA club. I believe any way you get him there is good. And he got sober and stayed sober for 3 months under my guidance. Then he got drunk. It didn't bother him much. He was used to it. But it sure raised hell with my ego. And I went back and got him again. And 3 months, drunk. And I never gave up. Never gave up. And I prayed about him a whole lot. So I said, God, you've been watching them sparrows too much to let me have this one, I'll tell you. And he had another affectation I know none of you folks have ever had. He'd go to faraway places and call me collect. Tell me that he was drunk. About 12 years ago, he got on for him what was his last drunk. In one of our local motels. And he called another fella from our club who's not half as smart as I am. And he never took another drink until the day he died. And I used to sit at him, look at him in the club and say, you ought to be mine. I And if I know anything of the treasure that God gives us in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like this. I owe him more than he could ever owe me. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. It's nothing. Kept me sober for 4.5 years. This is the treasure in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to get on from here. Let's go to chapter 5. The only statistic in Alcoholics Anonymous is rarely. It's all the statistics that we have in AA is rarely. We read it all the time. There's two lines in chapter 5 that rather obscure, and we don't hear them clearly sometimes. And they're my favorite lines in the chapter. Without help, it is too much for us. And then Eve remembers Bill. He had two sayings. It was always that way. He was a big errant Yankee. And one of his sayings was, well now. You remember that, when he'd disagree with you. And then was some project that he was so absolutely sure of, he would start the sentence with, if you remember, the point is, he would say. And he'd win his argument in the front of the sentence. And in chapter 5, the point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. This is the absolute sentence that has been the perpetuation of our society that makes us different from any other facet of our society. We're willing to grow along spiritual lines. And I suspect that this is the secret to our success that's transmuted under grace into a happy and useful existence. What else? Well, I don't know how to get out from here. Maybe I'll tell a story, and I love to tell it all the time. I've got the little feller here. I'll give it to him. We'll take a story about a sick guy and from another book. Let's take it from another book. We arrogant alcoholics do not have a patent on everything good. Sometimes we're biased in our own direction. Were it not for the understanding of people who have never had a drink, this society would never have come to where it is today. When Bill was looking for somebody to talk to in absolute desperation, he had to go through 3 non-alcoholics to get to Bob. Don't ever forget it. This story has to do with a demoniac in the scripture, and I like it very much because it depicts me so very much. It's about a sick guy, about a nut like me. They called him a demoniac in those days. They didn't have psychiatrists back there, and they were limited in their verbiage. If we'd had him under one of our psychiatrists today, he'd have been a catatonic or bedwetter or something, you know. He's a demoniac. Meant that he was a maniac full of demons. The story in the scripture says that he was so wild that no man could tame him. The manifestation of his disease were such that they had to keep him in fetters and chains, like me. Then it said that he got so bad that they had to run him out of town. Hoo-hoo! Like me. And he ended up on the riverbank, under the bridge, maybe, like me. If your imagination is half as strong as mine, you can see the picture of this. The absolute helplessness of a nut, the babble, the dress, and the odor. There seems to have been at that time a little carpenter fellow who was going around teaching some strange new philosophy of love. And he had a facility that we have not quite acquired in Alcoholics Anonymous yet. He could see no ill in anyone. And so he says to this cat, "Are you having some trouble, my friend?" And the nut in his self-pity said, "Trouble is my name. They call me Legion," which means many, the scripture. The little carpenter did not waste a minute. He saw what needed to be done. He didn't say, "Are you ready?" He effected a treatment that healed the nut, that was as little understood in those days as the treatment of Alcoholics Anonymous is understood today. It had to do with casting some evil spirits out of the nut and into some pigs, and they ran off into the sea and were dead. That's not the end of the story. There were some stool pigeons around, like there always is. And they ran into the city and told the people that owned the pigs. You see, in those days, the pig business was big business. And these stool pigeons ran into town and they told these people, said, "You out of the pig business." And as the scripture reads, it says that they went in mass to see what had happened. And here comes the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. When they got there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. We got one like that, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. There he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. And these people were real incensed at the loss of their pigs. And they were snapping at these guys, at the carpenter and the little nut. They prevailed upon them to leave. And I can see this fellow in his timidity, having come from one hellish existence and not having the chance to experience the joy of another. And he looked at the little carpenter and he said, "Let me go with you." And the little carpenter broke a rule for us. Everybody that he'd ever helped up until this time, he had said to them, "Go on, don't say anything about it. Go on and don't say anything about it. You were blind and now you see." But he broke a rule for us. And he said to him, "What I shall say to you, stay here so that others can see what has happened to you. Thank you so very much."